Okay, so today is September 2nd, right? 10:30 in the morning. We are in Delia, Kansas. I'm in the presence of Pope Michael, and this interview will be done by Tarangasati for the Religion in Kansas, Dr. Miller's project. This is going to be on the website, so all the audio and the transcriptions will be available on the website, and it will be public content. So everyone will have access to it. If at any time you would like that to be removed, that would be possible, but you're pretty much giving us permission to publish this on the website and elsewhere.
That's true.
Okay. So would you like to start by telling us about your family background in Kansas, how long you've been here?
I moved up to Kansas with my family in January of 1980. We'd been up to visit when the Society of St. Pius X purchased the property in St. Mary's, Kansas. I was the first Society seminarian to set foot on that property in 78. We originally moved up with them and were working with them through 1980 and 1981. We departed from them in 1981 when we realized that they were not following the Catholic faith properly. And so we decided to stay. In fact, the economic condition at the time, you couldn't sell property here. So we decided that was God's will for us to stay in Kansas. And we moved forward, establishing our roots here in Kansas, moving eventually from St. Mary's out here to Delia in the early 1990s.
How were you raised? Did you grow up practicing? Were you always Catholic?
Yes, I was raised in the Catholic faith, baptized as an infant in Christ the King Parish in Oklahoma City. Then we moved out further north in Oklahoma City, St. Eugene's Parish. And Mom was active in the parish. Dad converted to the Catholic faith in 1968. He'd been raised in a mainstream, I think the one there was called just the Christian Church in Oklahoma City, but they've been in several denominations as my grandparents moved around the country because my grandfather worked for an oil company, and that meant a lot of moving. So I was raised in the Catholic faith. In 1970, the Novus Ordo was introduced, and at that time we were introduced to the fact that there were priests rejecting the Novus Ordo and going around the country and celebrating Latin Mass. And finally, in November 1972, we stopped attending the Novus Ordo because we believed it was not Catholic. Mm-hmm. We attended only the Latin Mass, which at that time didn't come to our area. Sometimes we went like 5 months one time without seeing a priest, because there were very few priests at the time celebrating the Latin Mass anywhere in the world. And it took a while before we found other priests who could come more often. Then we were introduced to the Society of St. Pius X, which I mentioned earlier. I entered their seminary in Icon, Switzerland, 1977. We worked with them until 1981. We departed from them. And after I departed, I still believed I was called to the priesthood. So I continued my studies on my own. We were associated for a short time with what's called the traditionalist movement. Mm-hmm. Basically, you can define the traditionalist movement as anyone holding the Latin Mass in some form, because the theology on that, we could spend hours just going into all the theological differences there. That's not necessary. But I started seeing there was a common theme amongst traditionalists. They all rejected the authority of the church, especially the papacy. Now, they debate on whether or not John Paul II, who was in at the time, was pope or not. But in practice, they rejected the authority of the pope and the authority of the pope to govern the church. So I left the traditionalist movement and tried to figure out, okay, where should we be? In 1987, I was confronted with a doctrine from the Vatican Council in 1870 that there would be popes to the end of time. I had adopted the position that John Paul II could not be pope because he was teaching a totally different faith from the Catholic faith. And when I realized there have to be popes, well, there was no pope. So there has to be popes. There has to be some way in this extraordinary circumstance for the Catholic Church to elect a pope. And that's what led to my election as pope in July of 1990.
Could you tell us about the election?
Well, As soon as I realized the necessity of election, I've been in contact with people who held similar views on the Catholic Church throughout the world. I wrote a general letter saying, quote them from the Vatican Council says, we got to have popes to the end of time. There's got to be some way, somehow, we, as Catholics, the few remaining Catholics, can elect a pope. I'm starting to do the research. I'd like to invite you to join with me. About the same time, I got a letter from someone I'd never heard of. I don't know how he got my name, but being a small group, we all exchange information. He said, we need to elect a pope. I said, yes. And I wrote back to him, we need to elect a pope. I just realized that myself. And we started moving forward. And from 1987 to 1989, we'd run into people, and they would hold different ideas on things. And some of them even held to the heresy that unless a person is baptized with water, they are most certainly going to hell. And because I ran into that one so many times, I had a file in my old Apple II Plus. I'd just pull up the file, you know, dear so-and-so, opening paragraph, file, closing paragraph, and ship it to them. And think, this is what the Catholic Church really teaches on the subject. And we realized, because we wrote I got in contact with a friend in Denver, Teresa Benz, we wrote a series of articles to promote a papal election. And we incorporate articles from other people that already written on the subject, and we went over the basics. Okay, John Paul II isn't pope. The papacy is vacant. The church can't elect a pope. This is why, and this is how we think we should proceed, and combine the articles. When we sent that around, and that just didn't get people to understand it. So in 1990, we wrote a book that you may have seen. Will the Catholic Church survive the 20th century? Because we realized we had to address the whole question in detail, in depth, at the level of, you know, a theologian or a canon lawyer. That's how deep some of these people went, and they weren't understanding. So we wrote the book. It came out in January 1990. It was sent to people all over the world who believed John Paul II wasn't pope. That was the criteria for getting on our mailing list. Anyone, if we had your address and you said John Paul II wasn't pope, you got this book. And there are a lot of people who said they're interested in papal election. It reminds me of the gospel when the great marriage feast was put on, and man sends out his messengers to invite everyone to the marriage feast. The first one, you know, I bought a farm. You know, I cannot come. I married a wife. I cannot come. They all started making excuses why. Well, yes, we need a papal election, but not quite yet. Or not quite this way. But nobody could come up with a concrete objection. In fact, we go right up to the day before the election. Seven of us had assembled and were ready to elect. On Monday morning, we assembled, most arrived Friday, Saturday in mid-July. The dates have been sent, summons has been sent worldwide. So seven of us were assembled. That afternoon, two others arrived. Well, you should put off the election. And all right, it was basically two of us had a discussion. Ken Mock, who's one of the men that came, and myself. Because I come to find out, the other two people in the room didn't quite understand what we were discussing. One of them happened to be a traditionalist priest who came with Ken Mock. And the other was Teresa Benz, who admitted to me, so I never quite understood his objection, Ken Mock's objection to the election. And I got to thinking about this in the last few years as I was writing up my biographical information. We had a long afternoon session after they arrived before dinner. And I couldn't pin Ken down to anything. Then after dinner, we go downstairs to my library in case we need to pull out a book. We didn't pull out one book. It took me another hour to an hour and a half to pin him down to with a concrete objection. I said, Ken, I've already answered your objection. And I went through the complete argument why his objection was specious. And at the end of that, he left to go back to his motel. He says, well, we're going to think about it and decide whether we're coming to the election tomorrow morning or not. But the next morning, there was a message at Bellevue where we held the election on the answering machine. Well, we've decided not to come. No, reason why. But, so, and then one of the seven that come, a lady from the Netherlands, she decides at the last minute she didn't want to participate. So while she's waiting for her taxi to take her back to Manhattan, catch plane to get clear back to the Netherlands, we proceed with the papal election with six of us.
You mean, who were those six people? Do you remember names?
Being my mother and father, Kenneth and Clara Bodden, Teresa Benz, and then a couple who lived in Michigan at the time, Robert and Diane Hunt, who had come down for the election.
Okay. Very nice. Thanks. So could you just briefly give me a summary of Catholicism, you know, doctrine, ritual, beliefs, and the church structure, and then how you, where you found the corruption and where you thought, why you thought John Paul II was not Pope, and how you then tended to fix that.
Okay. Well, Jesus Christ found the church on Peter and the apostles, commissioned them to go and teach all nations. And he gave them a set doctrine. Most of it was given to them orally. That's called tradition. Mm-hmm. Eventually, some part of that was written down into the Bible. And then the church itself has defined doctrines based upon that tradition. So when we say tradition, a lot of it is now in writing from the Council of the Church and the popes. Because Jesus commissioned Peter and his successors to teach this doctrine unchanged to the end of time. And you can find the basic doctrine, the Apostles' Creed, which begins, "I believe in God the Father Almighty," etc. You can look, people can look that up. And you take a look at our catechism. A third of the catechism discusses the 12 articles of the creed and goes into detail what each one means. Another third discusses the Ten Commandments and what they mean. And the final third discusses the sacraments of the church and a few other miscellaneous things and what all that means. And it's a basic catechism. And the catechism, the Third Council of Baltimore authorized one in the late 1800s for use in the United States. And that one is back in reprint today, and you can go online and buy it. But that catechism is substantially the same as the catechism authorized by the Council of Trent, actually composed afterwards. The Council of Trent ordered it to be composed, to be given to every pastor so he could teach his people. The Baltimore Catechism is laid out at a more simple level, so you can start out teaching from First Communion classes when children first enter school on up through high school, whereas the Catechism of Council of Trent is meant for pastors. Although I'd say educated laity of today should learn their faith at the level of the Catechism of Council of Trent. Because if pastors are supposed to teach it from that catechism, the laity should be able to understand it at that level, especially if they're educated. And so that's the basics of the faith are laid out in the catechism. Now what happened at Vatican II, they departed radically from the faith. And I did write down a few things. Basically, Vatican II teaches a new doctrine. The first major doctrine, now there are a lot of things one can complain about Vatican II, but we need to boil it down to some simple points. The first one, the Vatican II implies, is that all men are saved. That is, all men go to heaven no matter what they do. And I call this a doctrine of universal salvation. Now, if you go into detail and from some speech and stuff, you do get the impression that, yes, there are a few people who might have made it into hell, but you have to really work hard to get it. Hell. Well, I got to thinking about that one. We study our catechism. Anything in life, we know, is earned. Okay. If you want to get a promotion at work, you got to work hard. I mean, we're not going to give the promotion to everybody that, you know, comes in, punches a time clock, and spends half the time in the, you know, coffee room. It's a guy who works hard, gets promoted up to manager or whatever. Well, heaven is earned. We have to earn our way into heaven by doing God's will, keeping the commandments, believing the faith he gave us. Whereas Vatican II implies everyone will be saved. Now, I was doing some research. This doctrine goes clear back to one of the fathers of church, Origen. Much of what he road is quite good, but he got off course, and he teaches a doctrine which has been named apokatastasis, which says in essence that eventually everyone will make heaven, including the devils. Hell will eventually be closed down. Well, that's come forward into Vatican II, only it's put more simply, and you can see it in the decrees. And then we get to a very distressing statement from the decree Nostra Aetate. And I'll quote this one. The Church regards with esteem also the Moslems. They adore the one God, living and subsisting in himself, merciful and all-powerful, the creator of heaven and earth. When you read that one, okay, what Vatican II is saying is Allah is God. Well, you can reason this out simply. Let's say there are two people who both adore one God. They're monotheists. Okay. They adore different gods. All right. Now, there are several possibilities. The first person could adore the true God. Well, if the first person adores the true God, the second person is adoring a different God, and therefore a false God. Or vice versa, the second person could adore a true God, the first person will therefore adore a false God. Or it is possible both to be adoring false gods and ignoring the true God, which is out here, adored by others, hopefully. Well, Vatican II is trying to, and you can see, even see this out in the world, they talk about the three great monotheistic religions, Christianity, Judaism, and Islam, as if we all adore the same God. Well, we don't. You take a look at the doctrine of Islam on Allah, is opposed to the doctrine of Christianity on the Holy Trinity, God, one God in three persons, Father, Son, Holy Ghost, which we studied in our basic catechism growing up. And so Vatican II, in essence, is saying we adore the God of Islam now, rather than the Trinity, because they're saying Muslims adore the one true God. And then we come down to what got to most of us and what brought us into awareness of the problem is the fact that Vatican II, afterwards, there was what we call the spirit of Vatican II, which got loose. Vatican II said this, some of which I've talked about. Then the spirit of Vatican II, they changed the rites of the sacraments. So instead of saying, and the consecration of wine at Mass, that for you and for many, and the Novus Ordo Mass, which is in the Vatican II churches at the moment, in most of the vernacular translations, that was translated as for you and for all. Well, we know all and many are two different things. Okay, if I have all the money in Delia, no one else has any money. If I have many of the dollars in Delia, someone else has some money. Okay, those are contraries. But these obvious things got to people like, hold it. The Church has always said for many in the Mass. I mean, we can go back to the 1500s. We can go back to the year 1000. We can go back to the year 500. We can even go look at the communion services of the Protestants. Everything from the most liberal on up to the Anglicans. They all say for many. We can look at any Bible you want to pull out. Catholic or Protestant, they all say for many. And I got a shelf of non-Catholic Bibles that about 2 foot long. And I've looked in a lot of them. They all say for many. So why is this changed to for all? Although, what's interesting, I brought this up at Kansas University in the presentation about a year ago in October of 2009. And there was a man from St. Mary's, a Novus Ordo priest, who was stationed over that time, he came to see the presentation. He said, well, they're changing it back to for many. I hadn't heard that. I did do some research. But that doesn't really solve the problem. Because in doing some research more recently, Rome was asked about this change in the vernacular translations. It was changed into Italian, French, German, English, Spanish, to the whatever the equivalent of for all. So questions went into Rome. Rome came back and says, well, Jesus really meant to save for all. That's what it says. There are two notices, 1970 from Rome. Jesus really meant to save for all. This was first proposed by a Protestant theologian, Joachim Jeremias, in the late 1960s. Because I remember a priest I met when he's trying to sort this all out in the early 70s. And he goes first to an Aramaic scholar, because the argument was Aramaic doesn't have a word for all, which doesn't make much sense to me, but that was the argument. So he said, I'm checking it out. He hunted down a Jewish Aramaic scholar, and he asked him, does Aramaic have a word for all? And the scholar told him, says, well, we don't have one. We have six words, which give the indication of all, depending on what you mean. You're like, the Bible says multitude, or it can say all. And we translate in different manners into from Aramaic into English. So the priest says, well, I thank you for your time. He goes to Rome, hunts down a cardinal. I think Cardinal Wright. And he says, okay, Cardinal, when Paul VI says Mass in Italian, what does he say? And Cardinal Wright says, per tutti, which means for all. And he says, my dear Cardinal, when he says Mass in Latin, using the Latin nose, or what does he say? Pro multis, the Cardinal answers, which means for all. He says, well, my dear Cardinal, until he can figure it out, I'm going back to the Latin Mass I know is valid with the for many. Because these are the things that obviously came up. And then also I ran across something. 1974, there were a lot of translations of the new rites of the sacraments, which came out from 68 to 72. And apparently, some of the translators were trying to repair the rite and translate it properly. Rome says, no, 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 we have substantially changed the rites of the sacraments. You will adhere to the Latin original we give you and to the instructions we give you, and don't monkey with it. So they have declared in the Vatican II Church that their sacraments are different from the Catholic rites of the sacraments that we've had from the time of Christ and the Apostles. And this is the main problem with that church, which calls itself Catholic, which is less Catholic than some of your most liberal Protestants, in my opinion.
Okay. So could you now introduce us to your church and how you've changed things?
Well, basically, we're not the ones that have changed, and that's the point I'm trying to make here. We are adhering to the Catholic Church founded by Jesus Christ on the Apostles. We're in the time which is called the Great Apostasy, looking at 2 Thessalonians chapter 2 in St. Paul's epistles. He says in there, there'll be a great falling away from the faith at one time in history. And we believe that occurred in the late 50s, on through Vatican II in the 60s, and was completed in the early 1970s. Well, so many fell away, they kept the buildings, they kept the name, they just dumped out the Catholic faith out the door. And so we are a small remnant of the faithful, have remained faithful to the Catholic faith from the time of Christ, which built up to a great big church, which was stolen in the 60s at Vatican II. So we haven't changed anything. We have just simply remained the same, and they have changed. And that's the big difference. And one of the points that should be made, there is evidence that shows that they're not the Catholic faith. In the end of the first chapter of Romans, St. Paul says, when people lose the faith, they start teaching false doctrines, they lose morals. And in fact, if you read it carefully, he's describing, in essence, the pedophile crisis that afflicts what's called the Catholic Church, which that rose up in the early 60s now. The evidence is starting to come out. It actually rose even in the late 50s because many of the priests were already losing the faith before Pope Pius XII died. But it really rose up in the 60s and got bad in the 70s, 80s, 90s. And even to today, and they're still, from Rome, not taking the logical steps. And you can see it in contrasting the Catholic Church, 1917 Code of Canon Law says that if a priest or a cleric, I mean, we're talking about someone from an early day in seminary, if they're caught in an act of pedophilia, they immediately become what's called irregular. But when you become irregular in the Catholic Church, you're immediately, and this is by law, forbidden to administer the sacraments, preach, function as a cleric in any manner whatsoever. And there are no exceptions to this law. This is 1917 Code of Canon Law. So, the second, the bishop of diocese would have been informed that any of his priests, clergy, whatever, seminarian, had committed an act of pedophilia, he would immediately have to jerk him from his office, from the seminary, and in the United States, the man would have, you know, two options because the church couldn't enforce it. In the ages of faith, in the 1300s, there would have been one option. The bishop would call him in and says, we're going to put you in that monastery over there. We're going to put you so far back, you can't even think about children. Okay, and they would have a place where they could not be a danger to the faithful, but still save their souls. Well, in this modern world, they'd be offered the room in the monastery, or well, we'll call the police and they'd come pick you up. Because even Pope Pius V, I think, issued a decree about pedophilia that the local authority should be informed in order to protect the faithful. Very innocent people, not just the faithful, obviously. Now, you go to John Paul II's 1983 Code of Canon Law, and you read, and it says something like, they shall be punished with appropriate penalties. And in practice, you can see the appropriate penalty was apparently they have to move across town to another parish. And that doesn't sound appropriate to me.
How do you, last of these, I'm doing these last ones, how do you, you know, practice your religion on a day-to-day basis as Pope?
Okay, as Pope, see, we are in that time of the Great Apostasy. So we do not have daily Mass, because that's an essential part of the Great Apostasy, is that the Holy Sacrifice of the Mass ceases completely on earth. There are no Masses being celebrated. They're pleasing to God on earth at this time. So we get up in the morning, we go to the chapel and pray a while, we do a little computer work, then 7 o'clock on weekdays, 8 o'clock on Sundays, we all get together, we have our morning prayers, our rosary together, and breakfast, and on to the day's work, whatever, whether it's, you know, taking care of the yard, studying, printing books, which is what we do to support ourselves. We're publishing books now, bringing old Catholic books back into print. Because there is a lot of interest in spiritual matters, and we're hoping that if people start getting a spiritual life, then they'll start seeing the problems of the church, and that's somewhat how we're picking our titles, or books that will teach them things about the Catholic faith they may not have been made well aware of, especially about the Great Apostasy. That's one of the books we brought back in. His Present Crisis of the Holy See by Henry Cardinal Manning from the late 1800s. And he goes into exactly what is going on today. And he proves theologically how this disaster will come in history. And I think he prepared this information because he's looking at it. He was seeing what he thought was the beginnings of it. He says, I don't know when it's coming, but I want to warn you, this will happen. It's not a matter of an option. Some prophecies, like the destruction of Nineveh, when Jonah prophesied, the king of Nineveh said, well, let's fast, pray, and stop sinning. Maybe we can get God to change his mind. And God did. Well, these particular prophecies will happen. And that's what he warned, and they have happened. Okay, we got off course. Well, we about 12:30, we have lunch. And after lunch, more work, a little bit of recreation, maybe an afternoon nap to rest up from the hard studies. On towards evening, we take a little break to watch Jeopardy and then the evening news, because it is important to keep up with what's going on in the world. We have dinner, and after dinner, usually a little bit of time on the computer, and then night prayers and off to bed into another day.
Okay. questions that's kind of related to that one. How do you fund your church? So how do you, other than publishing books?
Basically, we do get donations from a few people who are following and working with us for the Catholic faith now. And it hasn't been too expensive for doing the church part yet, but God has always provided what we need when we need it.
Do you publish books that are not about Catholicism? Like, do you have actually have a business, or are you...
No, we're staying strictly with Catholic books because there are literally thousands of good books that were printed like 1800s, 1900s especially, that we can get access to that are almost totally unavailable. Okay. Well, let's take a look through here. The Art of Prayer from the 1950s. Out of print, but when Mom found this in a garage sale a few years ago and picked it up and I got reading it, I said, this is the best presentation for a person of the 20th and 21st century on how to get started in prayer. So we brought it back into print. Here's Eternal Punishment from 1928. I have to admit, I haven't had a chance to read this one. But this one tells you about hell. After reading that, I'm sure you won't want to go there. I've read a few others that are in print. The Precepts of the Church. I found on my website about two or three people a day looking for information on the precepts of the Catholic Church, because not only is there no book in print on this until recently, this just went back into print yesterday. We finally approved it. There's not anything on the internet. You do a search for commandments of the Catholic Church, my site comes up first. And Phil wrote a book to summarize the condition of the church, and that's good. I don't see Present Christ in the Holy
City.
I know how much trouble I had tracking that particular book, and we brought it back into print. I asked a Professor Miller at Kansas University. He put the word out throughout the country. He couldn't even get me a Xerox copy. I finally tracked it down, University of Texas in Austin. They made me a photographic reprint, which was just good enough to barely print out and read, and I was able to convert that through an OCR program and through about two proofreadings. We probably got 95% of the errors out and brought back into print. But it summarizes what we're going through, and you can't find the book on Amazon until now. We have it in print. You couldn't find it in libraries, interlibrary loan. Even a religion professor could not track me down a copy. I finally was able to find someone and figure out and pay a pretty penny to get a photographic print of it so we could work from. After I got a hold of it, said, yes, I know, because I had one paragraph someone had signed in a book from the early 70s. I said, boy, that looks interesting. And I found a little bit more on the internet, probably about a page worth, from various people, all from the same section. And I got the whole book, said, this summarizes it. But we're bringing back books into print that I think people really want. Some of them are, well, what is it? Practical Method of Reading the Breviary. One we've got in the pipeline to come back into print. Someone typed the search term into the internet and came into our website, because apparently we got the page up for that, or we mentioned it's one that's in process. So I kind of figured when we started this project, that particular book, would there is a group of people interested in. And so we're hoping through reprinting the truth, and there's plenty of books out there that contain it, this will help get our name out to people. And then we are planning a couple of books that discuss the actual church situation. We'll bring them back into print and make them available as well.
Where do you sell them?
We're selling them on the internet, on Amazon, because you can go through a place called CreateSpace, and you have to process the book cover and the interior, and then they handle all the manufacturing. It's called on-demand printing, which makes it very easy to get something in print. You know, $5-$10 depending on the size of the book, and you're in print, and the CreateSpace puts you on Amazon, plus we're doing our own promotion. well.
Interesting. How large would you say your congregation is right now?
I would say I would have to estimate us at 30 to 50 people. It's there, but there's another group out there, and it's hard to estimate what their size is. But I think there are a lot of people who are standing on the sidelines watching to see what happens. Because I've got 60 subscribers to my blog email list. The websites, if you add them all together, are 100 to 120 visitors per day. And there's a lot of foreign interest coming into the website. When I say interest, I'm not talking about the person who comes in and leaves right away. I'm talking about someone from Italy comes in, you know, spends a half hour. Someone from Spain or Germany. Yes, a lot of Europeans. We're in contact with someone from Poland who sent in a list of questions that would take about, the list of questions are, you know, 30 to 40 questions. Would come in, and I've answered most of them. I need to get back to them and say, okay, now, Peter, I've answered all these. Which ones have I missed? Because they're very good questions. And I'm glad it's a early part of the month, because one of the emails came in, 25 questions on the 25th of July. Well, two questions on the 2nd of September. Maybe he's waiting towards the end of the month to come up with another long list. But he sent a couple emails like that, and were kind of cute. I think there's a large group watching and waiting. I think one of the things they're waiting on is for me to find a bishop, either a Catholic bishop, in other words, a bishop who never accepted Vatican II, or a successor to one, and that's a long shot, because the only legitimate Catholic bishops would be in either Russia or China, or in the former Soviet bloc, because Popes Pius XI and XII sent bishops in with the authority to consecrate their own successors because they could not have recourse to Rome due to the communist occupation. So there could be a 30-year-old bishop in, let's say, Russia right now, or China, who's a legitimate bishop, legitimately appointed to the office of bishop and consecrated by the bishop before him, who is possibly now making contact with the world through the internet and other means, especially since the wall came down, and they're trying to sort things out because there is some evidence of the existence of these bishops. In 1985, a bishop got out of China. He was released by the communist Chinese. He was, you know, like 80, 85 years old. He'd been in prison for 30 years. He was interviewed somewhere between China and Rome. And as he's giving the interview, and the interviewer goes through, and what do you think of Vatican II? Vatican what? He had never heard of Vatican II. Now, he does get to Rome and comes into immediate union with John Paul II. It's my opinion he may have been so brainwashed or tortured or whatever, he'd been weakened, he just would go immediately submit to whoever was there. In fact, it might have been a communist plot. But more recently, and when the wall came down, somewhere I've got a newspaper article or two, and we've heard rumors that the bishops in Russia started making contact with the emissaries coming in from the Vatican, and like, hold it just a darn minute. Something is not right here, folks. Everyone back in your holes. Go back into hiding. We have a new persecution coming at us. But now the problem is they're back in their holes, and they might be a little bit leery of us as well. So trying to make contact, although we've made contact, we sent 75 copies of Will the Catholic Church Survive the 20th Century into Russia. I did have an email from Russia a few years ago and asked them if they knew about the underground church, and they knew nothing. They spoke excellent English, because I don't speak any Russian. But there is evidence that the underground church is still there. It's usually circumstantial evidence. Of course, one of the articles, someone was interviewing someone from the Vatican, and the Vatican was saying, well, now that the walls come down, we have to get in there, because there are Catholics who believe in 1950s theology. I said, well, yeah, you got to get in there and tell these people who are Catholics that they need to join your church. and I don't think that went over too well. So we have that option for a mission, and we're praying and working on that, although there's not much we can do in the area of working, although we do have a few things working there trying to make contact. The other option is to find a validly consecrated bishop out here, whether a traditionalist or from some of the other lineages, old Catholics, Orthodox, whatever. Because as Pope, I can reconcile them with the Church, and then they could ordain and consecrate me as a bishop, and I could authorize them after retraining. They could function as a priest and bishop, maybe eventually even take charge of a diocese. And we are actively seeking bishops or in contact with bishops in this area, hoping to bring them around. Because amongst the traditionalists, for instance, there are many entered the seminary on or after I did, for the same reasons we left the Novus Ordo, or in fact, they might have even been raised, you know, from as a young child in the traditionalist movement, thinking this is the right route. They go through the seminary, they get ordained. And some of them have even now been consecrated bishop. And they don't really understand the full scope of the problem. One of the bishops we're contacting, he had never thought about the problem of the Pope till after his ordination as a priest in the Society of St. Pius X. Well, two priests left the Society to go back into full union with, I think, Benedict XVI was at the time. Might have been John Paul II still. Whatever. They go back, he thinks about the problem, says, well, they're right in leaving the Society, only they went the wrong direction. He left rejecting John Paul II as Pope. So he's now thinking about the question. So we've given him a little something more to think about, like, you need to come the rest of the way. The Church must have a Pope. You must be in union with the Pope to function as a bishop legitimately. So we are actively seeking bishops. I think once we find a bishop, and I'm ordained consecrated, you're going to see a lot of people come off the sidelines and come back into the Church visibly.
Okay, so would you consider that to be your ultimate goal right now? That's what you're working for that bishop?
The first goal is to find a bishop so I can be ordained and consecrated. Because I think once we restore the holy sacrifice of the Mass, then we make a big step forward to the ultimate goal, which is the conversion of the whole world to Catholicism. And when I say Catholicism, I mean here, not with Benedict XVI. And the fathers of the Church are in unanimous agreement that after the death of Antichrist, who was part of the whole great apostasy, and we believe it was Paul VI, who took away the Mass, after his death, the whole world will convert to Catholicism. So this is not just an ultimate goal like we think we can get there. This is one we believe we will achieve eventually. And I would think once we start on that course, we'd go from where we're sitting today with only a few people, such a small number as the prophet Isaiah says, a little child can name all the Catholics. We're going to go from that to the conversion of the world possibly within a decade or two.
Okay. You kind of touched on this a little bit, but I was wondering what your obligations are to your church as Pope. So exactly what you are responsible for.
Okay, the Pope is responsible ultimately to teach the Catholic doctrine to the whole world. Now, obviously, in most cases, the Pope can't, you know, teach all 6.5 billion people personally. With the Internet, we can teach a lot more people than previous popes could personally. That's why we have a large website, actually several websites, of presenting Catholic doctrine, so we can preach in that manner. Then, as Pope, we govern the Church, and that's why we'd like to get bishops. That's why we have seminarians training who will eventually become priests, possibly bishops. And we'll be sending men throughout the world to teach and basically re-evangelize the world, just like the 12 apostles evangelized the world in the first place. And our duty as Pope to direct the whole operation.
How do you perceive other religions? Like, how much tolerance do you have for, you know, Islam, Buddhism, other Christian denominations, you know, new religious movements?
Well, basically, in Psalms it says, all the gods of the Gentiles are devils. all false religions are ultimately being led by a devil. That's what's leading them. Now, the people themselves can easily be following this religion they were raised in. They were deceived into believing, especially in this time, Jesus said even the elect would be deceived. And that's what I think of, like the traditionalists and many who are close to the truth, they've been deceived in part. So the thing is, we have to distinguish between the falsehood of the religion, the false doctrines of whatever religion is, whether it's Protestantism, traditionalism, Islam, Hinduism, whatever, and the people who may be following this in good faith, because we do not judge their souls. It's not our place to judge their souls. It's our place to teach them the truth. Says, okay, this is the truth that comes from Almighty God. This is why it comes from Almighty God. Okay, and this is what you believe in whatever religion you're in. Okay, and now this is why it's wrong. In fact, eventually there will be priests and bishops who will study the various religions, and they, in fact, I knew one priest who said he was teaching in Vietnam at the time, and he was pointing out, okay, the Buddha said this, 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 and this. And then the Buddha asked this question. I forget what question it was, but he knew it. He said, now the Buddha said he couldn't figure it out. He says, well, I can give you the answer. And he ran into someone who listened to his radio program, says, you know more about the Buddha than most Buddhist monks do. Because we learn about these religions so we can point out, okay, now this is where they got something right, and this is where they are off course, and this is why they're off course. And that's okay. We can show you where the truth is. Because that's the main point, is to bring people to the acceptance of the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, so they can save their souls.
That's what would you say to a Muslim if you had a short conversation with them? What would you say was incorrect about their religion and their belief?
Well, basically, the Muslims, what they've done is they, in fact, some consider them a heresy that left the Catholic Church. And I'm sure modern Muslims haven't got the foggiest idea that Muhammad himself was influenced by a heretical monk and when he was formulating his religion. And when they're worshiping Allah, they're actually worshiping a pagan god, Alatel, that was in vogue in the Middle East at that time. He's one of many gods, but he was being worshipped there, and that's when he got back into Mecca. He said, well, name's a little off, but the god is Allah. Oh, okay, he's just like Alatel. We'll accept him. They don't realize the origins of their own religion. And I'd point out the origins of their own religion. You don't even know that you're worshiping a pagan god who was one of many pagan gods, maybe the head of pagan gods at that time, in that area. So, you believe in Jesus Christ? Well, he was not just a prophet. He was the Son of God. They believe in the virgin birth. It's in the Quran, as I understand. In other words, that Jesus was born of a virgin. Okay, this was all predicted in the Old Testament. They believe in at least parts of the Old Testament. Okay. So it's time for you to come home to where you really ought to be in the first place. Because you broke off, you know, 1,400 years ago. Door's open. You can come back in. Come home.
So what would you say to this idea that has become so popular that all religions are pretty much headed towards the same direction? There's one God, there's no true or false God, everyone's just worshiping the same supreme being.
I'd say that is a deceit of the devil. Because the devil is that one God which all these religions are tending to, whether it is the Novus Ordo, Protestantism, Islam, on out. Okay, they're all saying, yes, okay, you all worship one God, but we're down to the thing. You worship this God, I worship this other God over here. We're not worshiping the same God. Okay, so if I'm worshiping the true God, you're worshiping a false God. Now let us look at this a minute. Okay, if there is one God, he would teach one doctrine. There'd be one truth, okay? The sky is either blue or it is red. It's not, okay? It's either dark at night or it's light at night. we can't have two different truths. The true God, or even any God, is going to say, I am the way, the truth, and the life. This is the truth. This other is falsehood over here. Okay? That's where we can get into mathematics. 2 + 2 = 4. It doesn't equal 5. It doesn't equal 22. It doesn't equal 1,075. There are many wrong answers. There is one right answer. So, just as there is one right answer, there is one true religion. And one of the marks of the one true religion is that it's going to say, we have the truth. And therefore, if a religion is saying, well, if you don't like being Lutheran, you can go become a Muslim. Okay? Or Muslims would say you could become a Lutheran or whatever. Or whatever, because there are a lot of religions out there saying, well, you don't like this, you can go over here if it's meaningful, whatever. Then they're saying, in essence, we are not the true religion because we don't claim to be the true religion. We claim to be, we have something that helps a lot of people, you know, be happy and, you know, maybe even make it to heaven. But we're not claiming, we have the truth. And the true religion will proclaim, we have the truth. We have the whole truth, and it can only be found here. And so any religion that does not claim that is a false religion. But the devil's the father of lies. He wants us to believe 2 + 2 = 5, 22, 1,025, whatever. Anything but 2 + 2 = 4.
Okay. So my favorite question.
Okay.
What would you say to Benedict the 16th if you met him?
Well, first thing I would say to him, get out of my apartment, because he is not the true pope. I imagine we would have quite an interesting conversation, mm-hmm. because I would say to him, Joe, you're not a Catholic. We can remedy that. You need to leave this false faith, which you're now leading. You need to stand up on that balcony there at St. Peter's and say, I am not the Pope, he is, and point at me. Okay, now we got that done. When we get some monasteries back, you're going to get to go to the monastery to live out your life and save your soul. You'll never preach in church again. Because, let's face it, he's been preaching false doctrine since the early 1960s when he was running around in a business suit at Vatican II, although he was a priest. He wasn't even looking like a priest. The only time they start dressing up in the Novus Ordo until the last few years is when they make bishop. Then they got to get out all the finery with the red piping and stuff. They look like a bishop. When they're priests, you can find them running around in t-shirt and jeans. And that's, but he was doing the equivalent in the early 60s. Business as much as you get away with it. But yeah, that's, I tell him it's time for you to get out of my apartment, convert, and tell the world the truth. Because that's his duty. That's all everybody's doing, but his especially, because he's deceived 1 billion people.
You know how there's been a lot of criticism of the Catholic Church for, you know, extravagance and spending a lot of money making the place beautiful. Do you think that's a valid criticism?
No, that's not a valid criticism. So I was just reading that in The Art of Dying Well by St. Robert Bellarmine. Wealth does not belong to the wealthy. It doesn't belong to people. It belongs to Almighty God from whom it comes. And we're making the church beautiful. That is the basilicas, the cathedrals. We're making them beautiful for the worship of Almighty God who created the heavens and the earth. And the problem with the extravagance that has crept into the church at times past is when the popes, cardinals, bishops, priests, they started living like kings in their own houses. I like the example of Maximilian Kolbe. Someone criticized him in the late 30s, early 40s, after they'd had a tour of his printing press in Germany. He had the most up-to-date equipment for printing Catholic books, pamphlets, whatever he was printing to promote the Catholic faith. They said, well, you have all this fancy, brand-new equipment and stuff. He says, well, yes, I do, because we want to do the best job possible to promote the faith. He said, we have the absolute newest equipment here in this room to get this job done. He points out the window. You see those cells over there where the monks, where we all live? Those are the same cells our predecessors lived in 2 centuries ago, we haven't updated a thing over there. Except maybe to put electric lights so we can see get down the hallway. They're exactly the same as they were 2 centuries ago. In other words, they lived in the same poverty as Franciscans over there. But when it came to doing the work of God, whether it's publishing books, they had the best, or for the worship of Almighty God. Because we got to stop and think, who is God and who are we in comparison? This beauty is for the worship of God. And it's our duty to worship God the best way we can.
Okay. I have a question that I actually sent to you, so I'm sure you have this prepared. How come you were never ordained? Is it important at all, or is it an insignificant label?
No, it's an extremely important part because the Pope, as Bishop of Rome, is normally ordained a priest and consecrated bishop right after his election if he hasn't been beforehand. In fact, the first almost millennium of the Church, no man elected to the papacy had been consecrated bishop yet. Some were laymen, some were minor clergy. A lot of times the Archdeacon of Rome was elected as Pope, and sometimes priests were elected. So the original coronations of the Pope ceremony came out of his consecration of bishop. He was consecrated as bishop in the same mass and crowned as Pope at the end of it. It's only when bishops started coming in the papacy that there were two separate ceremonies. But according to the law of the Church, the moment the Pope is elected, he can be immediately ordained a priest and consecrated bishop. In fact, when man went into the papal election that morning as a cardinal deacon, and by the end of the afternoon he'd been consecrated bishop after being elected as Pope. That's how fast it can take place. One other Pope waited 6 months to be consecrated because he couldn't round up enough bishops. So there have been delays in the past. This is the longest delay, but I think God is trying to show people the authority of the Pope, as all authority in the Church, does not come through holy orders, but comes through election or appointment, as depending on the office. Popes are elected. The second they are elected and accept the election, they have full authority as Pope, infallibility to govern the Church, to appoint bishops, whatever. That comes from the office of Bishop of Rome. The holy order should be added to it, because many have the false notion, and it's perpetuated by Vatican II, that authority comes through the ordination, not just the appointment. And you get into the traditionalist, orthodox, old Catholic sects, they have the idea the authority comes solely through the ordination, or pretty much. So I think that's why God's delaying my own ordination. But it is very important. We've been working on it for the past 20 years. We are making some progress. We're at least getting priests and bishops to talk to us. In fact, we have 2 priests now working with us in the Church. And both of them are actively trying to find us a bishop. So we got help.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. going back to the concept of you being in Kansas, how do you think the culture, the geography, the religion of the people as, you know, a state would help you if you were to remain? Like, where else in America would you see yourself being more successful?
Well, I've never really thought about any relocation other than a relocation back to Rome. Mm-hmm. Because, I mean, the Pope is Bishop of Rome. Now, I mean, I might relocate if there was some practical reason to relocate somewhere else in the United States. But see, I don't think it was my choice. I think it was God's choice to restore the papacy in Kansas. Because people, I'm sure, in fact, I didn't realize until the last few years how much important in the Catholic Church happened in Kansas. I wonder how many people realize the very first martyr to die in North America died in the state of Kansas. The only debate is over where. Because nobody knows. As far east as Council Grove and as far west as Great Bend is the major theory.
But it was in Kansas.
It was definitely in the state of Kansas. There's no question about that, because he came up with the explorers. He stayed. He got martyred by the natives here. The next group that came up found out he died, and they were trying to Well, they're trying to find him. Where is Father Juan Padilla? Finally, someone, oh, he got killed. Because he made a few converts, but a few of the natives were not too happy with him. But they couldn't ever figure out, like, nobody knows where he's buried. So the first martyr in North America came from Kansas. One of the last martyrs in the Catholic Church also came from Kansas, Father Emil Capon. He died in North Korea because he was a military chaplain and was captured and was eventually killed in a North Korean prison camp, and he's buried over in North Korea. And people don't realize that. So there is a lot with the Catholic Church. The first bishop west of the Mississippi was stationed in St. Mary's, Kansas at first, and he's buried over here in Leavenworth. So there's a large Catholic history going back to the 1500s that connects with Kansas. In fact, my own family, my mother's parents and their parents immigrated from Moravia to, I just found out recently, the Salina area, because my great-grandparents are buried in Salina. No, my great-great-grandparents are buried in Salina. My great-grandparents owned a quarter section where the Mushroom Rock State Park is now. Because my grandmother remembered playing around that as a child before they moved to Texas. So my own family connected on that side to Kansas. Then on my other side, my dad's parents, when were up here in Kansas working in the oil industry for a while. My dad lived in Lyons, Kansas for a year. So, I mean, there are a lot of connections in my own family with the state of Kansas. But I think God makes these decisions, and that's why I'm here. So, I mean, I'm not looking like, oh, I think I'd be more successful in New York City or San Francisco or, you know, Wyoming or something. God's put me here, and he's got a reason for putting me here. I think maybe just the culture. Kansas is different from the rest of the country just from my own visiting. You know, the towns are different. Just the whole culture of Kansas is different from the rest of the country. And that God may be preparing to bring something real good out of that.
Okay. Is there anything else that you'd like to add?
No, I think we pretty much covered everything.
What do you think?
Enjoyed doing the interview. Okay. I look forward to seeing it up on the internet.
On the internet, definitely. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.